From cradle to grave, every moment of your life is one word after another, overlapping all the words from all of those who've crossed your path in a never-ending cycle of tale and experience. The concept is simple. The guest chooses the theme, a coin is flipped, and the winner is the first to tell a story based on their chosen theme. The loser gets to share a second. There are no prizes, no contests, no rules, and no boundaries. Just a few minutes spent exchanging the narrative from moments of our own human existence. From time to time, when life gets too busy and I haven't had an opportunity to book a guest, I'll go ahead and read you something of mine. Welcome to Tell Me a Story. The Long Longing, Chapter 1. I am a bitter man, and I'm jaded too. I'm pessimistic, angry, I'm disillusioned. I do, though, still believe. I believe that there is such a thing called love. I sure as hell believe it. Love is a backwater diner. Love is like a pork chop dinner at a backwater diner. There's lots of gravy, lots of butter, lots of flavor, lots of salt. It tastes good. It tastes really good. Nevertheless, a lifetime of that kind of eating will kill you faster than salad. But who wants to eat salad for an entire fucking lifetime? The first time my eyes tripped over you, I was at work. It was a new job. It was my third day. And I was standing behind the counter, one arm resting across the top of the espresso machine, staring out the front door, waiting for a customer. Anything to break the monotony. Time passes in so many strange ways. A busy morning and the whole day seems to pass in a matter of minutes, whereas a slow evening takes three times longer than natural and causes migraines of intense proportion. It was the middle of one of these headaches that you walked in. Now, I noticed you right away, of course, but not with the enthusiasm that I would the next few times you walked in. But I did notice you. You were wearing your hair in pigtails that day. You came in the door and you were laughing at something said by someone outside that you were with, and I don't remember who that was. You ordered iced tea, and after a few words to those folks that you knew in the shop, you were off and out the door. My first impression of you was fairly straightforward. You were pretty, and I could tell that you possessed a certain wit. I don't even think we exchanged a word. It was a couple of days later that you walked in again, and this time we did have a few words. I hope you remember. One of the girls you worked with sent someone else in with the drink order. Three iced teas and a coffee. Nobody told me that one of the iced teas was supposed to have a shot of cranberry syrup in it. Well, the drinks made it back over to your place, and without a second's hesitation, you, mighty heroic little you, came tromping over like a knight in Richard's crusade to right the wrong caused to you by that big new guy. And all the fun ensued. And I could tell by the way you used your words that you were comfortable with the language. And that whether you knew it or not, you enjoyed the taste of speaking. Your eyes had a twinkle, and I could tell you were enjoying making fun of me. It was like throwing rocks at a motionless cow. A cow chewing contentedly in a field. But you had a bit more sincerity. I tuned in to my best impression of an English professor with an American accent and protested my innocence with the boldest of words, the biggest ones that I could find. And while ignorance of the law is not innocence per se, I could see that you were not going to relent one little inch. You were having too much fun, right? So I was forced to take a bolder stance. I tried whining. How in the hell was I supposed to know how you wanted your tea? That's what I begged. You could have asked someone you questioned. How the hell was I supposed to know I needed to even fathom the possibility of needing to ask someone how to pour a fucking iced tea, which, by the way, was the order. I only filled the specific written order. You thought for a moment, and the twinkle seemed to shine a little, just a little brighter, and then you hit me from the left. You could quit babbling for half a minute and get the drink order right. So right out of the gate, you take the first verbal win. That had never happened to me quite that way before. You see, there's a tomboy that lives inside you, despite your stunning feminine form. And the combination of those two aspects, your brain and your form, is why I would like to believe that I was so attracted to you physically. The brute force of your spoken words are what I first fell for, sure. You're unbelievably beautiful every time you open your mouth and speak out of that insanely beautiful face. Now, how insane must a person be be, to begin to feel a certain budding of emotion? How inept and addle-minded would you have to be willing to subject yourself to such a thing? I mean, good God, it boggles my mind to this day. And nevertheless, it's not voluntary, is it? Have you ever held a tender memory in the palm of your hand and checked its shape and felt its edges, smooth with frequent touching and sharp with the points of fear or pain that tend to be ignored throughout each visitation of that memory in your hand? Thought and reflection on the state of a soul being the sum of a person's memories and experience, fear, love, happiness, the good and the bad. And that person's soul could be nothing more than the things they've done and the things that they remember. On the surface, a simple theory, but only a theological ground like belief in God, alien abduction, angels, fucking Sasquatch, or ghosts. We give ourselves belief in the hope that we can become more than the actual sum of ourselves. That in striving to become more by reaching for the unobtainable or the imaginary, we reach in theory a small collective of false residual memory or meaningless or strange actions by which we therefore reflect ourselves in a better light. Some sort of truth bending in an attempt to reach a salvation that without an actual base in fact or scientific evidence may be nothing more than justification of living and a denial of things which damage and taint and tear and scar a soul that might or might not actually exist. Taken in context or even out of context, depending on one's fantastic desire to believe, we see a trend forming within the base emotion of fear. Fear of fun, fear of emotion, fear of love, fear of pleasure, fear of physical stimulation, fear of sex, fear of the on and on and on. And these fears, when taken from a viewpoint of distant separation, become, or rather appear to become, self-serving and ludicrous. An unhealthy security blanket in which we wrap ourselves in moments of self-doubt and extraordinary trial. Now imagine spending a lifetime trapped by your own hand in a bubble that you cannot see out of, self-secure in the belief and the faith of an idea, a world in which the only escape is death. Listen, escapism is the base of all Christian theology, the action of accepting our lot in life because that opens the pathway of salvation. Salvation equals death. And death is nothing but a doorway to a world made up of angels, music, cleanliness, light, genuflecting beneath the throne of a dying and decayed idea of God, content and rewarded for the abstinence of participation in a physical life. Throughout history, a priest's best friend has been a simpleton without the cognizant presence of mind to question those things which are really a play on and a rape of the fears and the self-loathing of the mortal human thing. I remember you came in a few days later and you were talking with that long-haired guy from the frame shop. And I was invisible behind the counter for a moment as you two discussed your problems, your computer problems. I perked up immediately and told you that I'd be more than happy to take a look at your computer. That I had a certain flair with the mechanical when it was mixed with the electrical. And I own a lot of software. Hey, here's my number. Call me anytime. Now, you took my number with a strange look. Like, what the hell are you doing, giant coffee guy? And okay, you said in a tone that I heard say the opposite. And I was wondering if you would see right through me or if you saw me the same way I saw that dipshit in the mirror. The awkward, stumbling goof that seriously knows no beauty in that reflection. I bounced it off a friend later. So you just mentioned the computer and gave her your number? Yeah, that's about it. Well, what the hell could she read into that? I don't know. You feeling desperate? Look, buddy. I said I could or would fix her computer. And if it comes to that, which it's not going to come to that, then I will fix her computer and that's it. The probabilities are heavily against. But if I were to actually get my hands on that machine, I would have to bring it back here to our home. Now, one, would she let me take her computer away? A strange man with an expensive piece of equipment? Nah, it's not going to happen. And two, would she, in her paranoia over sending off her machine in the arms of a giant stranger, accompany the machine itself into the home of the aforementioned giant? That's just not going to happen. Look, you're not dangerous, not to women at least. And it's the computer I think I'm worried about. Well, sir, fuck you very much, I said. I remember the day the world turned orange. The sky was covered in a thin black mass of pregnant clouds whose time had come and needed to break water. They were black clouds. They reached as far as from the eastern mountain range almost to the western horizon over the Great Salt Lake. It was almost black, this darkness, in the late afternoon. The overcast threatened to completely obscure the sunset. And as my eyes became accustomed to the coming of night, the sun, in its descent to the other side of the world, peeked through a tiny break in the clouds, and suddenly the sky was on fire. Orange flames seemed to erupt amidst bales of smoky black cloud. And I pulled over to the side of the road, and I stepped off my motorcycle, and I reached into my saddlebag for a camera that I knew with a longing that hurt all the way inside, wasn't there. Other people all up and down the road were pulling over to look around them. And the world we knew was, for just a moment, changed forever. I saw a father holding his daughter in one arm and a camcorder in the other, and I knew that the camera couldn't really capture the intensity of the strangeness all around us. The orange, the color of it, all the tints, the hue of it all, it was fucking mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. And then it ended. And then it pissed rain. The sun finished its descent and the world was black again, and I felt a void open up inside me, and all of my worldly fears, my petty thoughts, all the pain I'd thought of that day, everything I've ever been sad or disappointed with broke free, and it was like a dam burst. I sat in the now forming mud, leaning against my rear tire, and I had myself a weep. I wept for my future because I knew it wasn't going to be what I hoped. And I wept for my past because of mistakes that I'd made, regrets that I held. And I wept for the orange that I would never see again. And I knew I would never have another moment as uniquely unique as this moment had been. I wept for downtime, and I wept because I knew I was going to feel alone. One original speck of time. Come and gone. Totally gone. I will never have that moment again. And I mourned that moment. Because the past is just a collection of these little moments. These little moments that should make you appreciate joy when that elusive little fucker happens to pop up. It was a yellow dress. I am human. I'm male. Red-blooded, as I have proven, probably an evolved redneck. And this was just a quick observation, but you are, as I have mentioned before, very, very beautiful. And brain or not, wit or not, repartee or not, intelligence or not, you deserve a second and a third look whenever you walk by. I've mentioned your inner tomboy and the fact that I like that about you, but like other men, I have a weakness for the summer dress. My mind slaps the back of my eyes and my eyes bug out, probably literally, but mostly metaphorically, and I'm left with a leering stare that is impossible to stop and next to impossible to conceal. And yours was yellow. It was a soft and faded yellow. Entirely concealing, and yet so sensual, so alluring. And while I managed to conceal my awe, I think, over your particular femininity that day. I'm afraid that I acted like a lovesick puppy for the rest of the afternoon. I must have visited you at work 5 or 6 times, as opposed to my usual maybe once a day. And you know that a dress like that, on a body shaped like yours, could make the mute talk in hope of making some connection with you at all. You could jumpstart a eunuch.
Somehow I'm leading someone else's life. I cut her star down with my knife. And right now I still see the way the moon plays this tune, though our night's died. My hands shake, my knees quake. It's every day, same way. 'Cause then came you, then there's you. Keep your picture in my worn-through shoes. When there's you, then came you. When I'm lost, I look at my picture of you.
See you.